Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Tonight's program is presented in partnership with the Lafayette Library and Learning Center's Glenn Seaborg Learning Consortium. You can find the club online at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Matt Richtel, technology reporter for the New York Times, author of Our Brain on Computers, and your moderator for tonight's program. It is now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished guest, Adam Ghazali, Associate Professor of Neurology, Physiology, and Psychiatry, and Founding Director of the Neuroscience Imaging Center at UCSF. And here's what you really need to know about Adam. He's got a storied biography and bio. I won't read it all to you. I'll just tell you about when I met Adam. I was in the midst of a series of articles about how heavy technology impacts the brain. I walk into UCSF, this majestic building on the campus in San Francisco, take the elevator up, and I see this. And if you're just listening on the radio, short clipped hip hair, silver chain, rings on the fingers, leather jacket, and I'm thinking, excuse me, sir, can you point me to the neuroscientist? I'm thinking maybe he's going to do my hair for $1,000. So, again, for those of you who are here, but also on the radio, you are bearing witness and listening to, I have interviewed lots of people, the single hippest neuroscientist on the planet Earth. And so to explain him and distraction in one quick story, we're going to actually talk about this. He tells me this story. One day, he's going to brush his teeth, lost in thought, looks down at his toothbrush and realizes he's squirted on moisturizer. So just one thing, one key difference between us also, I just would like to get on the record, I do not use moisturizer. And Dr. Ghazali does. Adam, it's actually a reasonable place to start. We're going to talk a lot about technology. We're going to talk about the brain, but I actually want to start with the brain to lay down a foundation. Adam, what was happening in that moment? Kidding or not kidding, but all kidding aside, you walk up and you've got your toothbrush, you're lost in thought. What was happening right there inside your brain?
Can't believe you tell that story. Well, you know, when we were sort of teasing out this idea of examples of distraction, and I mentioned that to you reluctantly, it's something that maybe you've experienced in your own way, but what it really does is highlight a point that there is a dissociation many times between where our eyes might be pointed and where our brain is pointed. And so although I was looking at the act of putting toothpaste on my toothbrush, I picked up, in my defense, a tube that looks rather like a toothpaste. But I wasn't looking at it. I was lost in thought, and I was distracted. And I went about this act because it was very routine, like I do every day, twice a day. And yet I did something that was entirely wrong. So what it highlights to me and why I think it is a good example, certainly in the broader context of distraction and the brain, is that where our senses are pointed and what we're trying to receive is not always a reflection of what's occurring internally. And so your mind can be directed elsewhere, although your eyes are pointing in a certain way, and you're processing information in a deep way that might impair your ability to actually see what's in front of you.
So it's actually a very natural segue that I'm not going to take. It's a good way into what's happening when we interact with our devices, but I still want to step back a little bit and to lay the foundation for what's happening inside our brains when we interact with anything, but in particular technology tonight, will you just tell us about the frontal lobe, how important it is for us as humans, how it makes us human, what it does, and then we'll talk about how it gets bombarded by other parts of the brain.
Great, sure.
So Matt really just summarized right there. The frontal lobes are the most developed, most evolved part of our brain. If you compare us to other animals, they're the part of our brain that develops the latest throughout one individual's evolution. And they're located, just as you'd expect, in the front part of your brain. The front part of the frontal lobes, the prefrontal cortex, is even the most unique and the most human in many ways parts of our brain. And what it does is it allows us to dictate how we interact with our environment. It's essentially our control center. Some people have taken this even farther and called it the executive center. This might be a little off. It's sort of the thought that there's sort of a chief executive sitting up there making all these decisions that you think of as yourself. We don't really think about it. It's called the homunculus in that way, that there's a little individual there just pulling the strings.
So, Adam, essentially what you're saying is we have a lot of decisions we might make and a lot of inputs coming in, and it is this part of the brain that helps us, what, set priorities?
It does all of these things that we consider our executive abilities, our ability to focus on information that's relevant, hopefully to ignore things that are irrelevant, planning, organization, how you control, how you interact with the world in essentially every way is really the domain of this part of our brain.
So I'm going to be a little opportunistic, and forgive me at the expense of a fine gentleman here. You don't know this on the radio, but someone in the front row dropped something.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened at that moment to me is, you played beautifully into our hands. My prefrontal cortex, my control tower was focused on this conversation. It is my priority. But some other part of my brain did something. Can you describe to us what just happened?
It's a great example. I was actually speaking at the time and felt the internal battle taking place. What happened was there was a strong stimulus in the environment, which is what we describe in our field as bottom up. So you pay attention in two ways. One way you pay attention is top down, what you're doing right now. You have goals of listening, looking at what's going on. Your prefrontal cortex is directing the visual parts of your brain, the sound parts of your brain to pay attention to it. That's top down attention. The other way that we interact with our environment through attention is bottom up attention. If something in your environment is very salient, very important, or very novel, it demands your attention, pulls your resources away independent of your goals. And that is the battle that I was facing. I had a very top-down goal of explaining to you about the prefrontal cortex. There was a strong stimulus there that was pulling my attention away. And I, again, using my prefrontal cortex, had to suppress that and stick with my goals. And it's that balance that is really actually one of the things that makes us most human, is to control how we interact, even when the environmental stimuli can be very strong based on our goals.
When you say makes us most human, meaning unlike either another animal or maybe even compared to a child.
For sure.
We have the capacity to make a decision, use our control tower, but it's not totally voluntary. I mean, I had no choice when I heard a sound to look. There is some civil war that goes on at that moment.
For sure. We're always a product of this interaction between top-down, goal-directed, and bottom-up the environment. I mean, if we were really fully top-down, we'd probably not be alive, right? And you could feel...
Wait, that's a key point. Okay. Sorry, forgive me. I'm just tickling his sensory cortices. My goal is to mess with his prefrontal cortex tonight.
He's good at it.
What do you? It's really key, I think, as we move to technology. What do you mean that are these bursts of challenge to our prefrontal cortex keep us alive? Give me an example.
Well, these are clues from the environment of things that are dangerous, even life-threatening, that we should be aware of. It's why animals, other than humans, are really good at surviving out in nature because they're very sensitive to these cues from the environment. But in our own environment, if you are so top-down, and as I was top-down when I was preparing my toothbrush and not paying attention to the environment, but if you are that way and you are crossing a street, then you are not sensitive to the environmental cues that you need to successfully navigate that transition.
So, in other words, however many thousands of years ago, our forebear is in the jungle and building a fire or a hut. That's the control tower. If we don't pay attention, when the lion shows up, that's the burst of, hey, what should I do? Mm-hmm. But if we're too top down, we just keep building the fire and get eaten.
For sure. I mean, I think it's a little, it's been a little bit of a trade-off, you know?
I haven't had dinner.
You know, with our top-down control comes the ability to do amazing things, like build a society like what we have. And that's because we've learned how to control how we perceive the environment and how we act in it in a very goal-directed way. But there's a trade-off. We've lost that some of that sensitivity to our surroundings that are critical for survival. You know, we have not lost it completely, but you can see this trade-off. You can also see it in development, just to finish up that point, that the prefrontal cortex being the last and the most evolved part of our brain compared to other animals is also the last part to develop in each person, especially its connections with the rest of the brain. And you could see that imbalance between bottom up and top down even right through the teenage years, which might not be surprising to you, right? So you have a young adult and certainly a child that has a goal. And then there's a bottom-up stimulus, maybe some food or, you know, something else that's exciting. And there's a whole new goal, right? Just a quick transition. The bottom-up stimulus is so strong, it drives away from the top-down goal. And that's something that we slowly develop throughout our early adult life.
So, okay, so I think we've laid some groundwork. For those on the radio, I'm holding up my iPhone. It is off. Adam, tell me about how this conversation, this foundation we've laid, relates to this device, what it delivers us, and the challenging position it puts us in.
So with technology and the many creative, brilliant people that keep pushing the boundaries of what we have sitting in our pockets, we now have this device that's so much more than it ever was before, just a way of communicate. It is a device that taps you on the shoulder, usually on the pocket, on your leg, and tells you that someone wants to talk to you or a new piece of information has come in. And so it is a bottom-up. It's not a top-down device anymore, purely that I have to call someone, where's my phone device? Where's my communication device? It's a device that's communicating with you, not on your schedule, not with your rule base if you keep it on all the time. And so it's a powerful bottom-up stimulus that is going to have at least some impact with your top-down goals. And that's sort of, I think, where it comes in.
Let's really be very specific about this. You're working on one of your research papers and you get a ping. One of our audience members is reading a book and there's a text. Are we responding to that because, and maybe it's all the above or one more than the other, because it's a sound like something falling on the floor, because it's a social cue, because what are the reasons why that is so powerful of a lure?
I mean, I think it's a little bit of all of those. And this is still something that is largely intuitive. There's not a ton of evidence on it. We know it's very important. So some of this that I'm going to tell you is based on anecdote and some intuition, at least on this part. But, you know, there's a lot of association with those texts and those emails and those phone calls that go off because it has the whole association of unknown, right? You don't know what it is. It's likely something in your social sphere, so it certainly has a strong social role as well. But in general, it is a novel piece of information. It is something new and unknown and exciting in that way. And we are novelty-seeking creatures. We always have been. It's been a lot of the source of our evolutionary development is to seek and develop. And so I think on a very primal, you know, basic level, we respond to that novel stimulus. And, you know, it has the type of cues in our brain that sets off this cascade that pulls your attention.
So one of the threshold questions I imagine people are wondering, we talked about a lot, maybe we don't know the answer, but that is a survival instinct. How do we know whether it has gone into overdrive? I don't have the statistics at my fingertips, but I've written about them. The amount of data we're getting today is manifold more than it was in 1960. It's there in your pocket. Do you have a sense, either viscerally or research-wise, do we have a sense whether we're putting so much pressure on our control towers, and this leads into kind of your direct research, mm-hmm. that we are causing anything from performance costs all the way up to danger?
Yeah, so I think that that is without a doubt what is occurring. You know, and I'd like to couch this in saying that I love technology and I'm certainly not against any of these things, but there is a clear impact of frequent interruptions and distractions on how we perform across almost every level. And it might be something as benign as that senior moment that I always describe when I'm talking about my research, that you arrive at the refrigerator only to have no idea what...
you got to put a fine point on this. You got to tell everybody about the refrigerator
right. So
test.
I think everyone here already knows what I'm talking about. Who knows what I'm talking about? See, so it is so common, I don't have to give you much of a description. By the way, if this was a room of, you know, across any age, and I've talked at high schools, even if there were 8-year-olds in this room, and I asked that question, everyone raised their hand.
Adam, before you go on,
of a surprise.
So you're going to tell us about why we forget what we came for, but I just want to pause and ask, is your research shown you actually what we came to get? Is it a sandwich or something to drink?
You could tell he's hungry.
All right. So what is happening there when we get to the refrigerator?
Right. So it raises a really, really interesting question that has basically been a fuel for my research for the last decade. You have one item in mind. You just realized that you wanted to get a sandwich out of the refrigerator. It takes you 7 seconds to cross your house and get there. You arrive there and have no idea what you're doing. And, you know, it's very shocking to you because you feel like you should be able to remember that. And you should. You know you have the capacity to hold a single item in mind for that period of time. So it's not really a memory question in my mind. It's an interference question. It's a question about attention and the host of interference that exists both externally and internally. And so that's really fueled my research. And that's sort of what I was starting to say is this maybe not such a serious event, this senior moment when you just make this small mistake at the refrigerator and wind up working through it. But this same concept of how being removed from our goals, either by our own choice, by attending to something else purposefully, or just being distracted by irrelevant information, derails our ability to accomplish those goals. And it could be something as benign as not knowing what's in the refrigerator, or something as potentially tragic as driving on the highway and making one of these type of errors.
Before we come to the fatal consequences, let me just ask you to put a fine point on it. In those 7 seconds, there might be the most innocuous interruption. I mean, what? You see the cat run across your path. How innocuous does the interruption have to be to derail your stated goal?
Yeah, very innocuous. And that's exactly what we study in our lab. So we do brain recording essentially in real time while you're interacting with an experiment that we create. And so we could see what's happening inside your brain in terms of activity while you're doing a memory experiment. Short-term memory experiment, just like that 7 seconds that you're holding something in mind to go to the refrigerator. But we challenge you with distractions and interruptions. And I just want to give you a little bit of the terminology that we created in our lab and use as the framework for our research. This whole concept, and almost if you think back just introspectively to your own experience of forgetting what you were getting at the refrigerator, you'll probably arrive at the conclusion, which almost everyone does, is that something caused interference. And that interference comes in many flavors. It could happen internally or externally. So externally, it might be irrelevant information, like a cat running across the room or seeing some mail that's been sitting on the table, even if it's been there a week. I call that type of interference distractions. Your goal is actually to ignore it, and it somehow finds its way in. Having a conversation at a restaurant and just trying to shut off all that chatter around you so you can focus on the person you're talking to. The other type of external interference is when you actually make the decision to interact with something else on the way to the refrigerator, let's say. So now the phone rings, so someone talks to you along the way. We call that an interruption. And that's a higher level interference. And before I tell you about distraction interruption and how minor the distraction can be and still impact your performance, I want to point out that all of these types of interference, that external interference, can happen in here. It doesn't have to be external. So you can have a thought that just pops into your head, even though you don't want it to. Or you could be multitasking internally and having another conversation with yourself about something you might do that you started on your way to the refrigerator. All of these forms of interference, external and internal, impact our ability to accomplish our goals. And it can be very, very minor. In our experiments, healthy young adults, 20-year-olds, in the scanner trying to remember a single face for 7 seconds. See the face, hold it in mind. Just seeing another face flash up in the middle drops performance. It's not very much. It's not a very hard test. But it consistently reduces performance, even something that mild.
I want you to define all these terms a second, but can I just get weird and existential for a second? Uh-huh. Does it suggest that being in control and setting goals is less important evolutionarily than we might have imagined? I mean, it sounds to me like if I can be thrown off by the cat and forget that I wanted a sandwich, or is the main thing that I remembered hunger, and that's the bigger picture?
I mean, on a survival level, you can clearly do very, very well being very bottom-up and being easily distracted and easily interrupted, because you'll survive, and you could survive quite well. But the type of way that we've organized our society and interactions with our environment and with each other demand much more than that. It really demands full out goal-directed behavior. So whether or not it was essential for survival, it's essential for modern-day survival.
I mean, that's a great point, and I don't want to lose track of a question I want to ask you about age, because mm-hmm. you mentioned senior yep. and young, but let me just stick on this for a second. Can you just reflect on the idea that on the one hand, technology is enabling all these goals, and on the other hand, slowly seeming to erode them? I mean, is that a conundrum at this point? How do you think about it? And how do you think about it in your own life
sure.
in the sense that it empowers you to write your research papers, send your emails across country, Skype with potential donors, whatever right. it might be, but also impinge
yeah.
you?
No, it's a great question, a great way of thinking about it. And it's important to realize that this is not some new problem of technology, right? This has been the story all along. This is the theme, that as we make advances, there's always benefits and costs. And we've always been trying to keep track of that ever since human civilization started, right? We always have had a balance between our tools and our technological advances and the impact that it has on us in a negative way. This is a new conversation about an old story in a lot of ways. And I think of that all the time. I mean, I love these tools, and they've permitted things that were just unimaginable. I have deep, deep research collaborations with colleagues in Europe that we could talk to face-to-face on a weekly basis, that we can even penetrate deeper into a problem than I can with people down the hall from me, because this is the person I should be talking to. Our ability to be able to write freely with a word processor, even when away from home, you know, feels like a tremendous advantage. But with each of these things come a cost and a decision. The ability to write away when you're away just because you have your laptop or your iPad with you is a tremendous advantage, but it also means that the ability to take a real vacation might be impaired, right? Who can relate to that, right? Here you are away from home on your vacation, and yet you're still checking your email and things of that nature. So, I mean, we all feel this burden of this immediate responsivity. So, you know, I think that in my own life, I certainly feel this push-pull of something that I love and something that I feel the negative impact of as well.
You mentioned the senior moment. You also mentioned having young people in the lab. Will you just tell us the performance cost from interruption and distraction? Does that change if we age? And if so, well, let me just start with that, and let me do a follow-up on that.
Yeah, so one of the main focuses of my research is the aging brain. At one time, when I talked about the aging brain, people assumed that I was talking about folks in their 60s, 70s, 80s, and now it means people that are not 23 years old anymore. We've come to realize that the aging brain is a lifelong process of change. It's not something that you sort of stay at some level and then change in your later years. This is for the types of abilities that we're talking about, this very top-down driven ability of interacting dynamically with your environment, this is something that changes very early in life. So first I want to couch that when I talk about aging, I'm talking about 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, a real lifespan change. And we know very well, and not just my lab, but many labs have been contributing to this literature, that our ability to resist the negative impact of distraction and our ability to bounce between multiple tasks, multitasking, declines with age. And by that, I mean that its impact that it has on whatever else you were doing is greater. In our lab, we study this largely in the domain of memory. And a lot of our research focuses on older adults, but now we've, as I said, expanded it to the whole lifespan. So this is a very, very clear finding in the literature, and its impact is very broad.
And so what does that say about, tie it to technology? If you are younger, you are more or less able. If you are older, what does older mean? You are more or less able. You are more or less susceptible to the interruptions.
Yeah, I think that first it should be clear that everyone has a cost from interruptions, even if you're a 20-year-old. And I know there's some people that think they're very good multitaskers, and the evidence is pretty clear that those are the people that are actually not very good at it. So there is.
You know who you are.
Yeah, we've done this test with audiences. I won't do it here, but there's clearly a misinterpretation of your ability to deal effectively jumping between multiple streams of information that is largely unfounded. But what we do know is that the burden of it gets worse.
Can we put a fine point on this?
Sure.
Also, multitasking myth. You do not do it. You do what?
Yeah. So. Just to unpack that a little bit, multitasking implies that there's a task. And so I first want to clarify that when we talk about multitasking, we're asking how you can do on more than one task. And a task being defined as something that demands your attention. So we'll say chewing gum is not a task. And therefore, you can chew gum and walk. Most people, right? Hopefully. And that's because...
There will be a test.
That's because the act of chewing gum has become not a task, meaning that it's become reflexive and subserved by parts of your brain that aren't involved in attention, like the prefrontal cortex. But if you are doing more than one task that demands your attention and your top-down resources, they will compete and conflict with each other and lead you to shift between them. Hopefully, rapidly and efficiently, but you are shifting. And that's what led to this concept of the myth of multitasking, which you might have heard. And that's the idea that when you're doing two tasks that demand your cognitive resources, you really don't run them totally in parallel. You move between them. And with each shift, there is a cost. And depending on how rapidly you shift, which is some of what our research is showing, that cost can be greater or less.
And the cost can be deadly if it's...
The cost could be deadly.
Adam, right about the time I was meeting you, I was doing this series, Your Brain on Computers, and I was down working with people you know well at Stanford, some mm-hmm. of whom you're collaborating with. And they told me about a test that you can do to just see how severe the limitations are of your ability to do two things at once. And correct me if I get this science a little bit wrong. I think this was born initially, a lot of this was born out of helping pilots in the world wars try to see how much they could handle in cockpits, mm-hmm. pilot error. And there was a cocktail party conversation task they told me to do where they said, sit at a cocktail party. You can try this yourself. Talk to the person who's in front of you and then try to listen to the conversation that's going on behind you. And you will see that you must rapidly shift between them. And they actually told me that generally, they're so limited are you in your ability to do both things that, and I think I have this right, there are two things you generally can pick up if you're trying to do in the other conversation. You can tell if the gender switched on the person standing behind you to talking, and you might be able to pick out your name. But beyond that, your only choice is to either listen to the person in front of you, mm-hmm. or listen behind you, which just shows how limited you are in doing more than one thing at a time.
Yeah, so that's called the cocktail party effect. It's the hallmark of our ability to attend selectively. And, you know, it depends who you're talking to. This is an advantage of our ability to process that fine-tuned selective attention. And what you just described is known as covert attention. It's the fact that you don't actually have to move your eyes or your ears to move your attention around. So we're actually very proud of our ability to do that and our ability to study and understand that. And it allows us to really fine tune and process some information with a very high degree of resolution. But it is a limitation. We cannot infinitely expand our resources to take in all the information.
So it's actually a nice segue to a question here from an audience member who asked, you know, why do some people demonstrate the inability to focus and seem less able to ignore distractions? Is it simply that there's a curve like anything else? Are there factors in upbringing? Are there factors in sleep. I mean, I imagine a lot of things, but
yeah. So obviously, you know it. I mean, you know that this is a multifactorial problem, and things like arousal, you know, your ability to sleep, what you've eaten, your level of stress, all impact your ability to focus. We know that your age affects it, right? We already talked about that. This ability to focus and resist distraction changes as you get older, and then there are just really interesting and somewhat unexplained individual differences. People in the same age, under the same conditions, might have a different ability to shut it all down and focus, and some others don't. So this is really a core research question for our lab, is to use brain recordings to understand what accounts for the ineffectiveness or effectiveness of some people to do it compared to others.
You're building an amazing imaging lab and doing some, and I want to talk about it in a minute, but there's another question that's come in here.
Sure.
That's a little bit related on the differences among people. And someone is asking a question we have talked a lot about over the years. It's the diagnostic statistical, what does the DSM stand for?
Okay, yeah, diagnosis, statistical manual.
Yeah, the manual of mental disorders is just beginning to let in the idea of internet addiction as a compulsive disorder. They're flirting with the nascent research. Someone wants to know about addiction, and I think that's do these devices have addictive properties? Are they addictive? What does that mean?
Yeah, so addiction is complicated. And all the DSM terms are complicated, and they're all in a constant state of evolution. I mean, my own personal view is that a lot of the problem with the diagnoses in general is that they're based on symptomatology and not the underlying mechanisms that lead to them. And there is actually a movement to reinvent all of them, from things like ADHD and depression to the underlying neural mechanisms that lead to them and allows you to separate them apart. I mean, addiction is largely characterized on its impact on your ability to function, right? So a lot of these are functional definitions.
So it's not whether you – it's not the fact that you can't put – or you have trouble putting your device down. It's do you have trouble putting the device down when you're doing something you otherwise wanted to do? Pay attention to your spouse, drive, do your homework.
And it's you know, sort of pervasive impact on your ability to form, to be functional. You know, even the diagnosis of alcoholism is really dependent largely on its impact that it's having on you. What might define someone might not define someone else. And so these are very functional definitions. And hopefully it'll change into more mechanistic definitions that we understand the real cause. And this will allow us to get a more pinpoint understanding of what's happening to each person. But, you know, there's certainly a debate going on now whether or not, certainly in some people, the engagement with technology, things like video games and all the media, electronic media that we've been discussing, whether or not they reach that level of being considered an addiction.
So we talked about the brain mechanism before about interruption. Let's talk about the brain mechanism of stimulation, because I think that's where this addiction conversation goes. What we talked about, the interruption, but what is happening to us, as far as we understand, or what do we speculate happens when we are interacting with our device? How does it stimulate us, and how might that be so compelling to us that we don't want to put it down?
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess it harkens back to our question, our discussion before about what, you know, why is it so appealing and such a strong urge to even check these devices? And at least a lot of the speculation, we're still waiting on data from this, but, you know, some of it's an extrapolation from laboratory experiments, even if it's not these same devices. But this exposure to novel information that pulls your attention in is associated with dopamine stimulation, which is part of our reward system. So it really stimulates our brain in some of the most basic ways that are associated with reward, and this reward system, when it becomes dysfunctional, is associated with the pathway of addiction. So meaning
that you interact with your device, you get a little dopamine, and then in its absence, you feel what?
Yeah, you feel that sense, you know, at the extreme sense, that withdrawal of not having it that leads to the seeking behavior. And what it leads to is a decoupling between the actual reward that you're getting, which can be zero or actually negative, and your neural experience of getting reward. And this is what leads to the really, what would be viewed as someone that's not in the situation of just really nonsensical decisions that are being made. Like, clearly these decisions are leading to very negative outcomes. How can you be getting a reward from this? And that's the negative cycle that can lead to this.
So in other words, my phone interrupts me during dinner and I get a little excitement when I open it up. It is the prince of some African nation offering to trade my Social Security number. But incidentally, I've tried this numerous. It does not pay off. But I guess that's the point, right? There's no payoff, but nevertheless, this is the decoupling you're talking about.
It's decoupled.
So why do I continue to fall for that? What is the part that is giving? Why at some point, why don't I say, is it because every once in a while I get paid off, so I mean, I guess I know the answer, but
yeah, and it's the very, you know, it's that very brief stimulation. A lot of the reward is just in that first, you know, moment of engagement. But this is exactly the type of issue that places the demand on our goal-directed behavior and our ability to actually make a decision if it has not reached that pathological entity of addiction, where you make the decision to change your behavior. And maybe we're going to come back to, you know, solutions to these things. But, you know, we have decision-making abilities. We are not necessarily, you know, we're not really slaves to these things if we choose not to be. But it might not happen passively. You might have to make decisions and put systems in place to avoid this very, you know, sort of basic draw that we have to these type of stimuli.
There's just along those lines, in the course of doing a series that I did the year before, Your Brain on Computers, I did a series called Driven to Distraction. And I met a guy named Dave Teeter, and his son was killed, and forgive me, I think it was Martin Luther King Day, forgive me if I misstate the date, when the son was in a car, and he was hit by a young lady driving a car the other direction, talking to her, a very sympathetic young woman who was talking to her church on the phone, killed Dave Teeter's son. And Dave Teeter used to drive for something like 4 hours a day to and from work. And he would become a leader eventually in trying to get people off the phone while they were driving. But the lure of answering his phone was so great that even after his son died, he said to me, "I cannot stop answering it. I have to lock it in my trunk." And I bring that up by way of saying that you're talking about we have to put systems in place. It sounds like some of those systems might have to be awfully powerful.
Yeah, I mean, and this will, again, vary from person to person. And so, you know, you find your own path. But you know, there are, you know, again, it's a top-down solution, right? You make the decision, you recognize a negative impact, and then you structure your life to minimize it. And they might be something very extreme. I mean, I've heard that one quite a bit, that you shouldn't drive with your phone in your pocket or in your coat because it's just too strong for most people, and that you should actually put it out of reach.
We're getting some great questions, and I wish you wouldn't make me look so bad with better questions. We'll talk about it. We'll all be having a word later. But I'm going to come to him in a second. I just want to ask you, how do you deal personally with this civil war? Do you just give into it? You're obviously highly productive. Do you have points where you say, "Oh my gosh, I'm having a problem"? How do you deal with
it? Yeah, for a long time, I was sort of just ignoring it, maybe like a lot of people, and going about I have a lot of streams coming in. I have a big lab and I run this research center, and I like information. I like the feeling of multitasking and doing a lot of things. So I was definitely the type of person that was very susceptible to it. And after doing this research, I finally looked at myself and said, "Well, I should listen to my own findings and realize that if, if I am doing something that is really important and demands high attention, I'm likely suffering a performance impact, even if it's not being quantified, so I'm not fully aware of it. I should know that that's what's happening. And so I made a decision to not give up all of this technology and multitasking, but to decide when to use it. So even to this day, I will say, when I am doing something that is critical, especially if it's time sensitive, I just shut it down. I quit my email program. That's my system, because I know just having my email program open and knowing that a message is there, even though I know one's there anyway because one's always there, I'm more susceptible to check it. If I actually have to open the program, that's enough of a hurdle that it leads me not to do it. Just feel too lame doing that after I quit it. And I close my door.
By the way, this is not a man, look at him, who likes to feel lame.
I close my door. I'll even turn my phone to airplane mode, and I will write. I will sustain my attention for a period of time in order to get the important information, my important goals done. But if I have a lot of boring things that are not demanding that level of performance, that are not that critical or sensitive, I'll just multitask away. I'll say 3 hours today, I'm just going to go through these things and clear the plate because, frankly, any of them are too boring to do continuously. I need to switch between them to get them done. So I'll just make a decision and give myself, that multitask period and that sustained attention period. And that's at least what I've been doing.
It's just really interesting that even though you say, and we know that the research is still mounting, that with all the important things you're doing, you have to shut off your email program to ignore it. It just shows how salient and how powerful technology is that, frankly, is getting better at getting our attention. Now the notifications and the flags pop up. Maybe it was once email, and then it was email and IM, and now it's email and IM and Facebook status updates. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a really, even if the research is still, anecdotally, we know something's happening. Here's a question from someone that's really interesting. He says, my son insists that he's able to listen to music and sing a song as he does his homework and that it doesn't distract him. I want you to be able to get involved in this family's problems.
Yeah.
And I also am really provoke something good. But more broadly, can you talk about this issue as it relates to young people, the developing brain, and whether the issues you've laid down with the frontal lobe and the impact from the sensory cortices are more profound, different, more interesting, or more concerning in some ways?
Okay. Well, we'll approach it two steps. Let me just, really lay into the question of music and distraction. It is a good one that we don't have the most complete answer to. We're actually doing work in our own lab right now on that. There is the suggestion, almost, counterintuitively, that exposure to some distraction might help performance. There is this amazing phenomenon that people go into coffee shops to work, right? It just doesn't seem to make sense after everything that I described to you. We're studying this formally in the lab right now, how information that is outside of our goals might help us accomplish our goals. And we have some hypotheses. One that I'll just share with you briefly is that the act of suppressing pulling on those mechanisms to dampen down irrelevant information happens internally and externally. And one of the hypotheses that we have in our lab, and if you ask people that don't like to study in libraries why they don't, and some of you might be those people, they will often tell you that they're too distracted. They feel their mind wandering away, and that's essentially internal distraction. And so the hypothesis that we're trying to get evidence for, I don't have an answer for this, is that the act of being surrounded by some distraction causes you to bring on the mechanisms to shut them down, and in turn winds up shutting down the internal distraction and quieting the system and allows you to focus. We think that might be going on, but we're not sure. We're investigating it. Music is similar in that it might have some of that that effect.
Wait, there's you've just... Is your son here, whoever asked the question? Because if not, then you don't have to tell him what he just said.
Well, music has another interesting fact that it impacts our emotional system and our arousal system. And that complicates it for us scientists that are trying to figure these things out. Because now we have this distraction facilitation that I just mentioned to you. We have something that might boost the arousal, and then we have an impact on your emotional state. And so music is complicated, and I actually often work with music on as well. The type of music has been shown. I mean, I won't go into all of this now because I don't have a definitive answer for you, but it is one of those situations that is more complicated.
So in other words, it's let's separate it out from young person trying to do homework, phone beeping, computer beeping.
Right. Music is a special case, and you know, and it's something that we're trying to tease out and understand. I know a lot of you intuitively get that because probably many of you listen to music while you do things. But in terms of the other types of interruptions, the one that are clearly interruptions that you're really not running in the background, the ones where you're I talk to a lot of schools about this topic, and I love to do that because I ask them what's going on. I have them give me my research projects. That's a great way to have research projects, is ask people about their own experiences and use that to guide our experiments. And they will say that they are working on their homework. A lot of them are really anxious because college is coming up, high school students, and they want to succeed. I mean, these are motivated kids I'm talking to, and they feel this burden immensely, and the impact of having their entire social world wrapped around Facebook and Twitter. And so these interruptions are a really important part of their lives, and it's right, you know, dead center impacting another important part of life, which is their scholastic achievement. It's also happening in the context of a developing prefrontal cortex, the very system that allows you to regulate how you deal with these bottom-up inputs and your top-down goals, are not fully developed yet. And so we don't have all the answers on development, but it is an important discussion to have of what is the difference between all of these complex engagements with the environment, between our top-down and bottom-up, of how it might be different when you have a fully developed brain and then you have a developing brain, especially in this way. So it's an important topic, and we're not there yet.
Is the hypothesis that if you're still developing, that your prefrontal cortex is still developing, that when that information comes in, it's going to simply be harder to ignore? So not only are those social cues really important, you're also not able to...
Exactly. And there's some data on that, even data from our lab with collaborators showing that what we call the top-down modulation mechanism that allows you to be goal-directed is lower in children. We've known this in many different ways.
What do we think, what do we know might be happening to long-term neurological development if someone is raised in an environment of constant bombardment? And let me just why don't you start with that, and then I'll ask you another a follow-up.
The truth is, we do not know a tremendous amount. Most of the data that I've told you and that you hear is cross-sectional data. And that's so we'll compare younger people with older people and say, oh, this is how the brain is different. But we know there's more things that are different between these two groups than their age. There's something we call the cohort effect, that the older... And when I say older, I could be talking about 30 or 40-year-olds here compared to, you know, 15 and 20-year-olds, that the environment that they were exposed to are very different. And we don't fully understand this. It requires what we call longitudinal studies to follow these people over time and see what the changes are and the impact of it. So a lot of these questions are open-ended, and the research is ongoing now. But one of the fears or concerns, and maybe this won't bear out, is that if you engage in your interactions with the environment in this very fragmented way, where you're constantly switching, as we described, which is what you have to do if it's attention demanding, will you not develop the skills and the neural mechanisms, the networks in your brain that allow you to sustain attention when you need to? I mean, pretty much, I could see everyone in this room grew up in a time where you were expected to sustain your attention on one single thing for long periods of time. And it's a skill that we think is important, right? The act of reading a book, in many ways, I feel, is dependent on it. Not that you're going to read a book in one sitting, but you know what I mean. Like, you have to read long enough to get into it, to get over that an intro, to really get through the whole thing. And how hard is it to do that if you do it in 3-minute segments? And so, you know, these are important things that are worth considering when we look at the developing brain. And we have the tools to understand these now, and it's certainly the focus of a lot of research.
I've been asked to do a very quick announcement. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program Our speaker today is Adam Ghazali, Associate Professor of Neurology, Physiology, and Psychiatry at UCSF, who is discussing the effect of digital technology on our brains. I'm Matt Richtel, technology reporter for the New York Times and author of a series, Your Brain on Computers. Let's continue on and ask a quick question. When I was asked to take questions from the audience, are these questions or we're going to do questions from the audience? Is this a good time? This is a good time. So we'd love to invite your questions. And I guess the only caveat is please put it in the form of a question. And we definitely want to hear your stories of how you interact with technology. But we would really love questions more so for Dr. Ghazali. Please. Can you, just for the radio audience, would you mind sauntering over to the mic?
Anybody who has a question,
while we're all getting prepared for this, will you just tell us about this magnificent lab that I saw today before we came over at UCSF that is just, it looks like, a holodeck meets Star Trek and what you're going to do there. Just give us... it's just fascinating. Tell us a second.
Yeah. So UCSF has a brand new neuroscience building on the Mission Bay campus that's fully devoted from floor to ceiling, 240,000 square feet of neuroscience on every level. I have the privilege of directing the Neuroscience Imaging Center on the first floor, where we, as a group, my lab and many other labs, study the brain almost in every way imaginable, in every age group and disease state there is. So we are, you know, talk about the pluses and minuses of technology. We are using the latest in technology and working with developers to push it even further to study how we interact with our environments, both external and internal environments, in effective or ineffective ways. One of the new exciting parts of it, which Matt was describing, is what I call the Neuroscape Lab. It's just an idea now and a vision that we're building out, and it's basically going to be a virtual reality, essentially, environment where you can walk into a natural environment and interact with it and maybe have memory demands or social interaction demands. And while you do it, we'll be recording brain activity in real time, even stimulating your brain with magnets and electrical activity, which is something that we found can promote plasticity in different brain areas, recording all of your body movements, your eye movements. And so the hope is that with this and the other tools that we're developing, we could get a much more sensitive idea of how your brain works, how it changes with disease, and how we can help improve it. So it's an exciting time for us.
Yeah, it's a gorgeous place. So let's go to our first question.
Yeah, that kind of leads into my question. In a person who has a developed brain, so not a child, but they have gone through at least late teenage into 20s and 30s, if there's something that happens either through trauma, through illness, through some situation that causes a dominance of the bottom-up reactions rather than the top-down, so they really are responding from a more basic level than a thoughtful level, is there a way with those people that the responses can be either rehabilitated or somehow re-regulated?
It's a great question. I love that question. That's, you know, I've been telling the story that you heard for the last 10 years, and it's sort of getting depressing for me, right? You know, here you are telling an audience that their brains are decaying and their ability to interact with their environments is never good to start with, but getting worse every year of their lives. And I was like, I cannot.
Enjoy the lamb.
Yeah, I just can't keep telling this story alone. And I want to help people, and most of us do it in research. And so for the last 5 years, we've been actively trying to use our research to guide the development of interventions to improve these abilities. What you described is very true, that you have a fully developed brain. I would go so far as to say that almost anything that impairs your brain, whether it's a traumatic brain injury or the host of neurological and psychiatric disorders, and you know the list, it's a long list, leads to this problem of increased interference, increased trouble getting your goals accomplished, more distractibility. They all have this in common. It's a very fundamental aspect of how our brain works. If you have a problem with your brain, you probably have a problem with noise in the system, which is what we're talking about. And so there are many potential ways of improving this. And we're working with the latest technology, this is this ironic part of all this, in trying to improve those abilities. So, for example, in our lab, we're using the paradigms that we use to study distraction and multitasking to basically create video games, which we know are immersive and interactive and have been shown to improve cognitive abilities. A lot of you might not know that. I'll be speaking at the Commonwealth in San Francisco about that topic in a couple months, about video games as cognitive enhancers, but targeted to improving those abilities. And that's one direction. There's other directions, including medications, which have some modest effects. In the end, I think it's going to be many different ways of enhancing plasticity. As I already mentioned, there are devices that can stimulate the brain electrically and magnetically, and believe it or not, this has been shown to increase plasticity in those brain areas if you're exercising it at the time. There's another technology called neurofeedback where you can actually see how your brain is working and shape it in that way. And this is, you know, these are the latest ways that I'm excited about doing research on, and many of my colleagues around the world, in seeing if we can improve these abilities.
Adam, how far away is a non-pharmaceutical approach to reorienting top-down versus bottom-up?
I mean, I would say we have that already. I mean, we have the building blocks of it. And we have experiments in our lab that we're publishing right now that are incredibly incredibly encouraging in our ability to improve these abilities across any age group. And now we're reaching out and looking at disorders like ADHD and autism and depression, traumatic brain injury, PTSD. All of these diseases have problems of this system. And so I don't have a definitive answer, but I have great optimism. We know that our brains are incredibly plastic. And by that I mean it has the ability to reshape, restructure itself in response to stimulation. And so we have great data and other groups do, and now it's going the next level, taking it out of the lab into real devices that can be distributed widely and hopefully improve this.
Let's go to another question.
My question is, again, with my son in mind, who's 9, video games, I'm glad you're going to be speaking on it. Can you say anything about how it affects the child's brain development?
Yeah, so from a developmental point of view, I do not believe there's an incredible amount of data. A lot of it, unfortunately, is anecdotal. Some of it is true and some of it is overinflated, and I think there's still a lot that has to be done to piece out impacts of violence, impacts of deep addiction, and how it might impair other things. And so I won't comment on all of that. It's definitely an important area and one of great research. But what I do want to tell you about is that the dark side of video games sort of overshadows some of the potential benefits. Because our brains are plastic and can respond to deep environmental stimuli, for those of you that have played video games, this is around as deep environmental stimuli as you can almost get. In some ways, maybe problematically, deeper than real-world engagement. It is highly immersive. The reward systems are finely sculpted by very smart people that want you to buy their games over many years, and this is a massive industry. And it's been shown that if you take action video game players, and this is what I'll be talking about somewhat in the talk at the other Commonwealth Club site, is that if you take these largely children or young adults and bring them into the lab and test their attention abilities, their ability to deploy their attention how they want to, and their distraction abilities and how quickly their brain responds to new information, they are off the charts. We can almost not even use these individuals in our normal studies because they are so far removed in their high ability to do this. Whether or not how this translates to every aspect of their lives is still unknown, but there is clearly the potential to use this type of interactive media to improve brain functions, and that's something that we want to take advantage of in some way, or at least try to.
Can I just be a downer for a second?
Sure.
It's mixed, but you know, when a lot of the reporting I've done is this doesn't necessarily pertain to video games, but it's when someone plays a lot of video games, it's opportunity cost of not being outside, setting aside the video games, people worry about obesity and they worry about... So there's a very complicated dynamic there.
I'll be an upper now on that same point. There is...
You like obesity.
No, there is...
You want a piece of me, Ghazali?
There is... I mean, so let's talk about Dance Dance Revolution. which is a video game that has been shown to have, through now formal studies, an incredible impact on reducing childhood obesity. And so, you know, with the new Kinect technology, which demands whole body movements, there's the potential of using video games. Now, granted, it's not the same thing as playing outside, and don't, misunderstand that. I'm not saying that there's not things to be managed here. But, you know, with evolving technology, there's also opportunity. Yeah. And it's been shown that there are powerful physical fitness benefits of some video games.
If you're challenging me to a dance off,
I thought that's where we're going.
I concede. All right. Next question, please.
There were several times in your responses that tangentially related to health and illness. I have a friend who suffers from seizures, and she firmly believes that holding a telephone to her ear or just being around the router will exacerbate the problem. Hmm.
That's interesting. I just recently wrote an article on this in comment to a really nice research paper. The data for cell phones having a negative impact on our brains is not very strong. There is some data, and I think that for most part the balance is that it's unlikely that there is a strong effect negatively. There is some interesting data that it can change brain activity by having close exposure to radio frequencies, but I mean, everything changes brain activity. It's being changed right now. So whether or not that's negative or not is certainly unclear. Now, a lot of that is related, you know, the research on its impact on cancer and stuff, and I don't feel like any of that data has really been borne out yet.
It's also very new.
And it's very new.
Because the cell phones exploded in use.
It's very
hard to get the longitudinal studies.
You know, as a scientist, I'll never say never. I just am telling you my interpretation of the accumulation of data is not overly convincing. It doesn't mean that new data won't come to light that would change how I view it. In terms of epilepsy, I don't know. I'm not aware of data on that. It seems that it can actually impact the neural activity, not just the talking on the phone, of the part of your brain that's closest to the phone. That's basically what this paper is commenting on, which is interesting. Someone with epilepsy has predispositions.
So keep it near the unimportant parts. Let's move on. We've got next question, please.
I had a question about your research method. You're using imaging. Is it a qualitative imaging where you're looking at brain structure, or do you have any quantitative methods?
It's all quantitative. Everything we do, so the methods we use are functional magnetic resonance imaging, electroencephalography, and a tool called transcranial magnetic stimulation. And what these tools allow us to do are to probe how the brain responds to any stimulation. Now we're doing things internal stimulation, like internal distraction, and obtain as best as we can quantitative measures, and we have many of them, and then do statistical comparisons across populations and individuals to see if, you know, to help make sense of all this. But yeah, I mean, this is the exciting field of human neuroscience. It's really exploded in the last 10 to 15 years. Almost all these experiments were performed on animal research models until very recently. We have the tools that allow us to see sometimes correlates of what's happening in the brain in real time and the entire brain while you interact with something.
We're running low. We've got maybe time for two more, certainly one. So please.
I've been fascinated with what you've said, but I'm curious how this relates to people in other countries and especially the children, because here every child has a cell phone or some kind of electronic device, and it seems to be a big challenge to get them to focus on anything. But you said you're dealing with people in other countries and Skyping, and I'm wondering, you know.
I mean, it seems to be a largely worldwide pervasive issue, the boom of technology in general. I mean, you also have to remember the cell phone and the mobile technology is in many ways even more accessible than computers. So what's happened over the last 10 years is even changing. There's recent data that, you know, a lot of the, socioeconomically challenged and underprivileged groups actually use more mobile devices. It serves many ways as their computer. And so we're seeing a worldwide trend of these. And obviously it's different and you know, developing countries probably have certainly have less access. But it's certainly a dialogue that a lot of the world is participating in.
And certainly in some countries like Korea were much earlier to address what they would deem internet addiction, and they have big treatment centers and video game addiction. We're down to our 2 minutes, so let's take one more question. I'm sorry for those who are still in line, but let's wind up with this one.
Are there treatment centers available that patients could go to be evaluated and to develop more control, top-down control, especially someone who has been extremely bright, very productive, created a number of patents, had a brain, a minor operation in the frontal lobe, and is unable to develop and control, make any decisions and solve any problems?
Yeah, so, you know, I mean, interacting with your local medical center, a lot of psychiatry and neurology groups have these types of, you know, maybe not specific for top-down, but certainly for frontal lobe deficits. And, you know, we need a lot more of it. It's definitely one of my missions is to make that type of treatment more accessible. So I think we're just at a high impact point of recognizing that we can do more, and hopefully we'll have more of those available.
I want to thank all of you. Let's thank all of them.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Great.
And and I want to thank you, Adam.
My pleasure.
And next year, same place, same time, dance off. Thank you.
Let's have a thank you to Matt. Wonderful moderator, knows how to dig.